Good afternoon. I'd like to call a meeting of the House Resource Committee to order at 1:34 p.m. We are in room 124. Today is Wednesday, I think, February 17, 2015. Our members present today are Representative Josephson, Representative Herron, Representative Seaton, Representative Tarr, Representative Olson. Our Vice Chair, Representative Hawker, is excused. He's actually got a bill up in front of the Finance Committee. And our co-chair, Representative Nagyak, is also excused. And I am co-chair Tallarico. And Representative Johnson, I do believe, will be here later. But I'd like the record to reflect that we do have a quorum to conduct business. I'd also like to recognize our staff. Our secretary is Julie Kohler. Teleconference aide is Matt Kern. Thank you both for being here today. Committee aide from Representative Nagyak's office is Gary Zepp. Gary's here in the room. If you need any assistance, anything, just get a hold of Gary. And Julie Morris from my office is right up front here. I'd like to ask you all to please silence your cell phones. And today we are continuing hearing the mining tax, House Bill 253. I believe we have the Department of Revenue and DNR. And Commerce is here as well, or...
Commerce isn't here today.
Okay, so we've got the Department of Revenue and the Department of Natural Resources here with us today. So if I could get the presenters to please come forward and put yourself on the record and your affiliation, and we'll begin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Jerry Burnett. I'm the Deputy Commissioner, Department of Revenue. At the meeting on Monday, we went through a presentation. There were a number of questions, and we brought some responses to some of those questions. With me is our Deputy Director of the Tax Division, and one of the things that we brought today is the annual report of taxes, which was just completed last week for 2015. So we could, I'm going to let Mr. Spanos go through some of the parts in that pertaining to mining.
For the record, Brandon Spanos, Deputy Director with the Tax Division, Department of Revenue. And I've been asked to show in our annual report how mining fits into the overall picture of revenues collected by the Department of Revenue. So, and I apologize, this is created in HTML. It actually looks really good online. It looks terrible in printed form. It's very small. And this is a PDF, which is also very small. So for a presentation, it, when we don't have the internet connection, doesn't look great. But you can go to our division website, tax.alaska.gov. There's a link right on that front page to the annual report, 2015 annual report, and it would be much more readable. So there's a few pie charts. This first one just shows the mining tax returns received. So this is the number, volume of returns. You can see that by and large corporate income tax receives more paper filings, or rather tax returns. They can be electronic. Mining is on the bottom. It's the yellow slice. It accounts for 2.14% of all the tax returns received. The next pie chart shows the revenues collected. So this gives you an idea of where they fit in the picture of how much revenue received by the state of Alaska. So as we all know, oil and gas production tax is the largest piece of that pie chart. Mining fits in. Again, is the rather in this chart is light blue. It's 3.24%. It's on the left of the slide there. 3.24% of all the revenues collected by the tax division in fiscal year 2015. And those revenues we'll see in some later slides here. They do kind of jump around from year to year. The mining tax is a fairly unique tax in Alaska. It's based on the net income of the taxpayer. Other states, I think we've provided some information that shows how other states tax mining, and some tax by weight of a product, some tax by the sales, some tax by gross income. Alaska, it's a tax that's been around for a long time, and it's been based on net income. And so based on how much net income that company might be making in a year, or rather taxable income, the tax can vary from one year to another.
Thank you. I'd like the record to reflect that Representative Johnson is here. And Representative Seaton, you have a question?
Yeah, thank you. On the net income calculation, is that a annual calculation, and so if there's a loss, is that the loss not carried forward to a future year, or is that just if you lost money or made expenditures in 1 year, are those just not ever further considered in the tax calculation?
So for the or through the chair, Representative Seaton, through the mining tax specifically is an annual tax. It's on a calendar year basis, or if a taxpayer reports fiscal year federally, they'll report on a fiscal year, but it is just that 1 year. For their corporate income tax, there's a net operating loss carry back and carry forward, but for the mining tax, if you have a loss in 1 year, you aren't going to pay that mining tax in that year, but there is no carry forward to another year.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
So I'm going to scroll down. These are all the taxes that the division collects in alphabetical order. So we're going to scroll down to mining here. And again, online, there's a link. You just click it, and it goes right to mining. So that looks like it starts on page 26. And each of the tax types, this is a program. It generates this pie chart. Actually, that's, sorry, the end of the CPV tax. So mining license, it goes over first the history, the description of the tax. It shows the rate calculation. So I'm not sure how much was, I didn't attend the previous hearing, so I'm not sure how much of the tax calculation we talked about or was talked about, but the 0 to 40,000 income bracket, there is no tax at that level, and then it graduates. And, of course, the governor's bill is proposing the increase to that top bracket. So the page 27 at the bottom of that is the kind of the meat of this part of the report for the mining tax. It shows the general fund, the CBR fund, and the tax collections. So CBR generally are audits and assessments get transferred into that fund. Refunds out of that from something that went into the fund also come out of that fund. And tax collections for 2015 were $38 million in the mining tax, but they do, as I mentioned, fluctuate from year to year depending on the income reported on the tax returns for our taxpayers. And then the pie chart there at the bottom shows again how that fits into the overall tax collections. So again, it's 3.24% of the total collections for the that the tax division collects, and the 96.76 for all others.
Representative Josephson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Could you repeat what you said about the CBR fund? How does the CBR fund work in conjunction with the mining tax?
So the CBR is for resource. So oil and gas is the common one that everyone thinks of, but mining is also a resource. And therefore, if the way the Constitution reads, I believe, is it used the word disputed, if I recall correctly. But yet, it's been interpreted as an administrative proceeding. So, if it really starts from an audit or an assessment, that's so a bill that we send to the taxpayer. They have appeal rights. There's their due process, and if there's a payment on an assessment, then it's transferred into the CBR if it's related to the mining tax.
Follow up.
So for example, the most recent year you report here, FY15. $38 million came in statewide in an uncontested way, and $70 million came in.
I believe that's 1,000.
Okay. 70,000, thanks. It doesn't seem like much.
No.
70,000 came in through a contest of some sort where there was an adjudication and disposition after an audit?
Correct. Through the chair, Representative Josephson, correct.
All right. Okay, thanks.
Thank you.
And then there's some additional information there at the bottom. That's the filing information. We often get asked how many taxpayers do we have in a particular tax type. For mining, The number of tax returns we received was 616, but there some of those could be amended returns, and the way we're reporting this, I believe I'll have to double check, but amended returns in 2015 could be returns from previous years, but they're counted as a return received in fiscal year 2015. The number of taxpayers is 468, so we received more tax returns filings that year than we have taxpayers. And in the mining tax, I'll also note that it's a license tax, so you must get a license with the division before you begin your operations. And then when you get that license, that there's a requirement to file a tax return. So even if you don't mine that year, you still have to file a zero return with us. It's an information return at that point. And then a lot of those returns are the under $40,000 of net income, so the return shows no tax, but there's some information on the face of the return. And also our the licenses are public information. Most of our information is confidential. The licenses are public, so they're available online. You can go run a search on what licenses are out there and who those licensees are. And then this PDF is a little bit old. We have updated the credit section that added a couple more credits that are available in the mining against the mining tax. And that sums up our annual report.
Any question? Representative Seaton.
Thank you. And on the tax credit portions, because that's one of the things we're dealing with, can you explain in greater detail those tax credits and how they're applied and how they can be applied, their extent, and you said there's several other ones available
there were,
now?
There, to my memory, two more. I'm going to pull up on my device here real quick the report so I can make sure I speak correctly to what we added. So the education credit is already on this. There's the film production credit that's available to take against the mining tax, as well as the minerals exploration incentive credit that's available. And those are the two that we put in there. And we can, again, that's available now online. We can also provide, we're going to try to provide a better PDF that doesn't, that isn't so small, that'll have these two credits on there as well.
And
follow up.
And Mr. Chairman, I don't know if we're at the right stage, but I'd like to drill into the exploration incentive credit more. But I don't know if we want, do we have the right person?
Yeah, we do.
Oh, good. In 2730-010, it appears that the exploration incentive credit can be applied to any land within the state, which means federal land, mental health trust lands, those that we wouldn't receive any, or private lands. We're providing a tax credit where we wouldn't receive a royalty. Is that right?
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, I'm told I am the person, but I'm going to look back at someone else here.
Was that in the information that we received? Sorry. Was he? No.
So I'm going to have to look a little bit more into that. I believe that we have had some response to some of those questions, but I've been pulled in many different directions today and just haven't had a opportunity to,
sure,
to dig into it.
And, you know, the response we got was not, okay, you know, very broad. So maybe, Mr. Chairman, can I go ahead and put several questions on this issue kind of on the record so they can respond to it?
Please.
So the first is, does the exploration incentive credit apply to all lands within the state, whether the state owns them, whether we get any tax or, of course, it's a credit against tax, so any tax. And also, there was a question on royalties, and I think the answer was no, but I'm concerned that on that where is that it applies under the statute to both the mining license tax and to royalties, Specifically, it applies during a tax year or a royalty payment period. And so it appears that the 50% royalty or 50% tax applies to both royalty and to tax. And also, I would like some indication of how these are applied, because as I read the 2730050, it can be applied for 15 years carried forward. But it doesn't have to be, it can be non-consecutive years, so it can be applied whenever you desire to for 15 years, and it seems like that has a, at $20 million, that has a large fiscal implication to the state's ability to receive revenue from any new mine, both revenue and tax, and if it's a credit against royalties, 50% of royalties, then it's also a question there. So I would hope that we can look at that. And let's see. I guess that's the majority of my questions there. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Through the chair, Representative Seaton, I can respond to part of that question. If I understood it correctly, you were asking if the credit can be applied both against royalties and against tax.
Mm-hmm.
And the form that we have is available online as well for completing that, and the credit can be taken against both, but it's not, there's no double dipping there. You can take it against both in the same year if you choose, and the statute doesn't identify which one it must be taken against first. Like federal statute, it often says the credit must be taken against this first, and then this, and then this. Certain types of credits, or there's a ordering. For this particular credit, there's not an ordering. The taxpayer can choose to take it against the royalties or against the tax, but they can't take the same amount. The form basically starts to chop away at the credit, and you can only take your credit once.
Thank you. And Mr. Chair, yes, and that's the way I read it as well. But my concern was that royalty is our ownership interest, and taking a tax credit against royalty is actually meaning that we are not only taking our taxing authority and reducing that, but we're also, in essence, reducing our ownership interest or the payment on ownership interest. So I think that a further discussion on the applicability of the exploration credit at a future time, Mr. Chair, I'd appreciate that.
Thank you. Representative Josephson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Two questions. The first is, what did the administration look at 2730 in advance of offering the mining tax legislation increase? Was there consideration? I'm not saying that reform is called for. I'm just asking whether some scrutiny was given to whether reform is called for.
To the chair, to Representative Joseph, Mr. Jerry Burnett, Deputy Commissioner, I'm not aware of any specific consideration to this. This is a exploration incentive credit that's been in place for a long time. Its existence is not necessarily an issue relative to the tax, because the purpose of this is actually to increase the tax over time. So it's not something that we looked at in terms of it reducing our taxes. That we look at it more as an incentive to produce more revenue in the future, and it's not a large amount of dollars that are actually been taken against our taxes. So,
and follow up. Thank you. Relative to the discussion from Representative Seaton about using credits in places where we earn royalty, I'm trying to see first whether that's inconsistent with what we do on oil. I think it's not, right? I mean, we offer credits obviously on our own land, and whether the policy should be different for mining versus oil and gas. It seems like that's worthy of some discussion, but I guess I, in a sense I'm asking Representative Seaton about that. In other words, we obviously offer credits on state land where we earn a royalty. Do you mind if a little banter or discussion?
A little banter.
Okay.
Is okay.
Is it your view that that there should be a different policy for mining?
And through the chair, Representative Josephson, normally, like on oil and gas, we have oil and gas production taxes, and those are on production, but it generally doesn't apply to the royalty amounts. And here we're saying that it applies to our ownership amount, or can be applied to our ownership amount, and I think that while we have this section of the statute open, we need to consider the implications that we have for the state of Alaska and whether that's applicable or not, or should be it.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. That I think he clarified that this really is a different application as it's against the royalty interest itself. Thanks.
Mm-hmm. And through the chair to Representative Joseph, if I could, this is Jerry Burnett again. On oil and gas production taxes, the credits there apply on state and other lands there, so your tax credits, although most of the production and most of the production value is on state land, you would still get a credit against production from non-state land because the taxes are on non-state land as well, as long as it's produced in the state of Alaska.
Thank you.
And we'll get an opportunity. I think Mr. Fogles can probably describe a wide, varied difference between the two industries, and it can be an apples and oranges comparison sometimes.
I think so.
Thank you.
So, if you have no more questions for Mr. Spanos, I think I'd like to bring Ed up to talk about some of the questions that were asked for that are DNR-type specific questions or mining-specific questions.
Okay. Are there any further questions from the committee? Doesn't look like it. Thank you very much. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Ed Fogles, Deputy Commissioner of the Department of Natural Resources. And based on some of the questions during the last hearing, we provided the committee with two pieces of information. There's a three-page document. The first page has a title of Alaska Mine Production Figures on the front. And it's just a simple spreadsheet showing a five-year look back on all the five major hard rock mines in Alaska and their kind of the commodity, the production of the commodities. So that gives you an idea of how much they produced. And then you can look on the following two pages at a five-year look back on the spot prices for those commodities. And so I think the question was, well, you just wanted this information so you can get a feel for, you know, what those numbers were. So hopefully that is of some use to the committee. And then the second document, I believe Representative Hawker asked about a lawsuit in the 80s that was relevant to production royalties. And you should have received a copy of that case. It's Trustees for Alaska versus the State, 1987. And you're welcome to look through it. The elevator speech condensation is that prior to this lawsuit, we were not charging royalties for mineral production. After this lawsuit went to the state Supreme Court, we were forced to pass our law in 1989 that instituted the 3% royalty. So there's a lot more in this lawsuit than just that, but it deals with Section 6I of the Statehood Act. So, you know, it's just for the committee's information.
Just to be clear,
Representative Josephson,
just to be clear, prior to the instigation of this lawsuit, we did not collect a royalty.
That is my understanding, Representative Josephson, through the chair. I think we had some kind of system where we were offsetting any kind of payments with annual labor, and there was no formal royalty And so that was challenged, and then now we have the royalty system in place.
Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just saw the lawsuit when I got here, the adjudication of that. But the royalty itself was done by statute, by the state of Alaska. My understanding in digging into the legislative history was it came up as we had to do something, and nobody wanted to spend a whole lot of time because we didn't have a lot of large mines at the time, and so 3% of the net operating, just mirroring the tax, was just thrown as a placeholder until people would devote more time to a adequate royalty system. Is that your understanding as well, or do you have you looked at the history of that?
Representative Seaton, through the chair, I have not had the opportunity to look into the legislative history there, so I'm not in a position right now to comment on how that number was derived, or whether it was temporary in intention, or too high or too low, or anything. So,
thing, Mr.
Chairman.
And one thing as we go forward, looking at, and we touched on it the other day about the appropriateness of having a net income percentage representing the royalty instead of something based on point of production, or net smelter return, those kind of issues where we are actually getting a return for our actual minerals, not for somebody's operating costs, and whether they're an efficient or inefficient operator would harvest the same amount, but it would very drastically change our royalty picture. So, Mr. Chairman, I don't think that I don't know if we want to get into that now or not, but that's something I just want to lay on the table, that as it goes forward, we're probably going to be discussing what's an appropriate royalty and an appropriate base for royalty. And so if the department has anything they want to contribute, I wanted to make sure that they had the opportunity.
Yeah. Well, Representative Seaton, through the chair, in my years with DNR, I have not been aware or involved in any real hard discussions on whether this 3% was the right number or whether the method of calculation was the right number. I don't think we've really had the opportunity to have those discussions. And I'm guessing part of the reason is there's, again, only one mine in Alaska at this time that production royalty really applies to in any meaningful way. I mean, a lot of the smaller mines, but Pogo is the only mine on state land currently, and there really isn't anything in the pipeline for a hard rock mine that's going to come online anytime soon, on state land. That's just general state land, so just never been a real. I don't think there's been a lot of real pressure on us to start evaluating that.
And the reason I bring it up is if we're going to make a change, we want to do that long in advance so that people know, and you're not dressing, oh, there's a new mine starting up here, let's change the royalty valuation or change the tax rates at that point in time. I don't think that's a good thing for the state to do. We're much better off considering whether the royalty is an appropriate calculation. If it's not, putting one in so that everybody knows the game way ahead of time. Otherwise, it's like targeting a specific individual, and I don't think we should ever do that. So thank you for allowing me to have that conversation.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman. Representative Heron.
On this, Ed, is that, if you look at the determination is that the number two plaintiff is from my region, and then you look at the rest of them. So it wasn't that this group of people necessarily were looking out for everybody and figuring that the mining industry needed to pay a royalty. What's beneath that, though? Was it because of fish versus mining?
Representative Heron, through the chair, I really don't. I'm not familiar enough with the case to know you know, the sort of the nuts and bolts of what drove it, but I never was under the impression that it was an environmental issue that was at stake here. It was just a fiscal issue is my impression.
Representative Josephson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We're sort of in my wheelhouse because this is when I look at case laws, like it, my eyes adapt well to that. But it says, if you look at proceedings below on page 4, it describes that indeed this was about the plaintiff's assertion that we didn't follow Section 6I and that we needed to collect a royalty. So it wasn't really a mining, although that may have been a backstory, a mining versus fishing dispute. It wasn't the question presented. It wasn't the issue before the court.
That's my understanding, Representative Joseph.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I just bring up the point is that I think it is, but that's beside the point. It's interesting that this group of plaintiffs would feel it was their responsibility to point out that 6I is not being is not equitable across the strait, across the state. Excuse me. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mm-hmm.
Representative Josephson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Mr. Fogles, I have this feeling that buried in a stack of documents is the answer to my question. But relative to the 3%, when I think of Utah, Nevada, and the other major mining states, not that we're necessarily one of them, but is there some way comparable to the 1/8 that applies sort of nationwide on oil fields? Is for a comparable rate on royalty? In other words, setting aside deductions and credits and the like, is there some figure that other major Rocky Mountain producers or states are using that we're not using?
Representative Josephson, through the chair, I don't know. I mean, that's something that, I mean, I haven't spent a lot of time looking at royalties in other states, and I think, you know, part of that is that, you know, the state land situation is vastly different in other states. Some states don't have state land, some states don't have the subsurface, and so it's really apples and oranges for the most part. If you want, we can spend some more time looking into that. I'm not sure how much good information we'll be able to get that will be of use to you guys, but
Representative Tarr and then Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And just thinking about the conversation about adjustments to the royalty rate or, you know, even the tax changes, I just wanted to be reminded, you know, for the active mines, you know, the operating ones are different and even the permitting ones, but for the ones that are in pre-permitting, like Niblack and Bokeland Mountain, which everybody had a lot of excitement about, when those leases are up for renewal, how much of an opportunity do we have? And that would be the point where we would actually make that adjustment, right? Would be when a lease was renewed, and that would set the terms of if we were going to make an adjustment to the royalty rate. So I just want to understand where in that process that could happen, and if it's not at least renewal.
Well, Representative Joseph Tarr, through the chair, I mean, Nidlac and Bocan are on federal land, so we wouldn't have any royalty on those at all.
Okay.
Right, so
can I do a follow-up, Mr.
Follow-up.
Chairman? Thank you. Well, let's take an example that's on state land then. How would that work in terms of the timeline of when we can actually make a change like that?
Representative Tarr, through the chair, if I'm understanding your question, are you saying when could we change the law to change the royalty rate for that for state lands?
If I might, Mr. Chairman, we could do that at any opportunity. What I want to understand is the impact, like the timeline on the leases, and when the lease renewal would come up, and how that would impact any underlying changes, how that would impact that process.
Representative Tarr, through the chair, I don't think it would. The 3% in statute, it doesn't change based on lease renewals or anything else. It's just going to be 3%.
Mm-hmm.
So there's no opportunity to change it other than by statute.
Follow up.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess I'm trying to understand whether that would be a deterrent for someone at the time of lease renewal in terms of them reevaluating, you know, the opportunity? And is that when we might see something if people were going to depart from the activity they were engaged in right now?
Representative Tarr, through the chair, I mean, I suspect that once someone has invested the capital to start a mine operating, and there's a lot of momentum there, they're going to keep operating it as long as the economic conditions are favorable. Mm-hmm. And there's probably a multitude of factors. The primary one's probably going to be the commodity prices at the time, right? So mm-hmm. that's what's going to drive their decision whether to it's not so much the renewal of a lease or the claim is insignificant cost compared to operating the project. Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. they'll probably keep on. I would imagine even if they had to temporarily shut down mm-hmm. A mine such as the Nixon Fork, they're probably going to keep keep their property position mm-hmm. legal and up to date. Mm-hmm. I don't think that would really have a bearing on this.
Follow up.
Final one. So. But specifically for, you know, the ones, the seven that are listed in the pre-permitting, so mm-hmm. they're not operational, and so right. still making, you know, right. calculations right. about the yep. financial viability of the project. Do you right. think even under those circumstances, the lease payments are so low relative to the opportunity that these changes are not going to impact that?
Well, I mean, it's Representative Feller through the chair. I mean, it's probably a very complex decision for the person holding the property, but, yeah, I mean, you know, for the most part, mining claims, for example, I think we have like, 35,000. I can't remember the exact number of mining claims in the state, mm-hmm. but people stake new claims and they relinquish claims. Mm-hmm. When gold prices are low, mm-hmm. you see them shed. People just drop claims, right? And so, you know, they're all making economic decisions every year. Can I afford or should I maintain the my claim position here? And mm-hmm. I would imagine if there's some change in the fiscal structure for the state, that would affect people's thinking on that, and I'm sure that some folks might be more inclined to shed their claims should the fiscal structure change.
Mm-hmm. Representative Seaton.
Thank you.
And just on that point, you know, claims are there and they're held, so nothing's happening with those that are not done. So if there's a 3% net smelter return royalty and somebody decides to shed that because looking at the existing infrastructure previously, they haven't been willing to go forward, they've just been holding it, mm-hmm. Maybe we'd actually get more mines created because you would get miners coming in that were actually moving forward and not holding claims. So, you know, that's a hard nut to decide on whether a small incremental amount that they have to pay the state is a net negative or a net positive, because it may, as you say, loosen up some of those claims and get those that aren't going to be developed relinquished. But what I would like the department to do, if they could, is can you supply the committee with the other private royalties, what you know of those in the state? I mean, mental health trusts are not secret, and they're up to 5% net smelter return or gross amount on the value of the minerals, and we have mines occurring on mental health trust lands, mm-hmm. and we had private lands where it's 4.5% net smelter return. And two mines that are some of the big mines in the state that are another. So if possible, can you find out the royalty terms and basis for the operating mines, you know, whatever is publicly available, to help the committee decide what is the appropriate basis? I mean, if it's the appropriate basis for most of the existing mines in the state to have somewhere up to 5% net smelter return as the basis for the private royalty, mm-hmm. And the state is not availing itself of those same economic conditions that people go forward with and develop mines on, then it seems we're leaving a lot on the table. So if the department's able to bring forward to us any of the publicly available information on those, that would be helpful as we go forward.
Representative Seaton, through the chair, we'll do our best. We'll find out what's publicly available. I suspect that much of that is, you know, confidential negotiations between the mining operator and the landowner. But you know, we'll see what we can pull up.
Thank you, Mr.
Representative Justice.
Thank you. On the subject of assignments or homework for the department,
we love homework.
I'm told that in Canada, which is obviously a pretty pro-mining state or nation, that they use a 10% to 15% net smelter return royalty. Mm-hmm. And I'm curious, first of all, if that's right, and you may not know that sitting here now, but 10% to 15% net smelter royalty or rate, and how that equates with 3% mining license tax that we use on income. I'm just curious about the relative comparison of those.
If I could, this is Jerry Burnett again, through the chair to Representative Josephson. We did provide the committee with some reference material on Canadian mining taxes, et cetera. So I haven't got through the details of that, and I know it was I sent it to the committee staff. You may or may not have it in your packet yet, but to the extent that may answer your question, it may not, and if it doesn't, we'll provide the additional.
Thank you.
I'll just say I appreciate the department and the information you've gathered so far. I know it's near impossible to create head-to-head comparisons when they're all entirely different. When one Western state charges a 5% net tax, has no corporate income tax, mm-hmm. or no royalty associated with the product, mm-hmm. or others just do the corporate income tax and don't really do that net tax, and they do it by royalties. Some do it by tonnage, production rates and volume. So going head-to-head, I think, is going to be very difficult, because ours appears to me, anyways, to be structured entirely differently than most of the other Western states that I've looked at, for sure. I appreciate the effort that you've put into it so far. I know that's near impossible to do a head-to-head comparison.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, we have provided the committee with comparisons of state severance taxes and then a non-petroleum corporate income tax collections by sector for the state, so you can see over the past several years how each sector has performed. And you know, it's very interesting if you look at mining tax. The corporate income tax on the mines in Alaska in 2010 was a negative $2.5 million, and it was $81 million in 2011,
right?
Which really looks at that commodity price worldwide and how that fluctuates and other things that happen. So we're providing you whatever information we can find to help you make your decisions.
Okay. Representative Seaton.
Thank you. I had seen that 2.5% negative income tax. Can you explain how we got the creditor, what application we got to get to a negative income tax?
To the chair, Representative Seaton, Brandon Spanos, our deputy director, is probably here. We can't get specific on what was to each one, but corporate income taxes allow you to carry forward losses from previous years, and you're taxing on an allocation based on the company's U.S. income tax or in U.S. income. So it is one where the loss could occur in Alaska, it could occur somewhere else, and it could, you know, in the previous year. So there's, as with all of our corporate income tax, there an allocation based on either worldwide or U.S. income.
And so is it worldwide apportionment, but most of the mines just were U.S.? Or?
To Chair Representative Seaton, I believe the mining is U.S. Income. The oil and gas sector is worldwide.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mm-hmm.
If I may, Brandon Spanos, Deputy Director, Tax Division. We also, to clarify through the Chair, Representative Seaton, there are sometimes very large amended tax returns that are refunds. So a taxpayer may choose to change their method of expenses or some other claim, and our normally we will refund those, and we can go back and audit at a later period. So it may be a large refund in 1 year, an audit, and a claim in the next year or future year. Or potentially we agree and it just remains as a refund.
And Mr. Chairman, in the depletion allowance that's used in mining and the shifting from cost depletion to resource depletion, can you explain how that affects the taxes?
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, I'd have to have the statute right in front of me to go into detail, but there's a depletion allowance. There's a, depending on what type of mineral you're mining, you have a set amount in statute for just a percentage depletion, which interestingly can go over what your actual costs were. And then there's a cost depletion allowance, which is more usually used in industry.
So, Mr. Chair, so the depletion, can you just explain to that? I mean, we're normally understanding how the costs are there. I mean, and they're deductible from your profits, and so you come out with where your net is. But can you explain, in addition to the expenditures that you make, how depletion allowance, what it is, and how it affects the taxes?
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, the basic concept of depletion is that there's a mineral in the ground, and you're depleting that mineral, and the costs associated with getting at it, so your upfront expenditures, similar to depreciation, you're taking the costs off each year to as the resource is depleted. So if you know how much is in the ground, if you're mining coal and you know how much coal is there, you can deplete that over the life of the mine. The statute allows for coal a specific percentage depletion. So it's not a traditional depletion method of saying that it's going to last for 20 years and there's this much, so we're going to take off, you can calculate mathematically a dollar limit that you would deplete each year. The statute, I believe, I wish I remembered the number off the top of my head. I think it's 10%. I don't recall for coal, but that's allowed each year, regardless of how much depletion you've actually calculated on your books.
So, Mr. Chairman, so let's say you have a hard rock mine and it costs you $50 million this year for your operational costs. Where does the depletion come into that? Is that instead of wiping out your expenses, or is that in addition to your expenses? You get to say, we've got $1 billion worth of minerals in the ground here, and so we're going to take 10% of that, and here's our expenses, and we're going to take another $100 million of depletion and write that off against our income? Is that basically what we're talking about, an additional reduction in profitability?
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, that's correct. It's in addition to your other expenses. So depletion is its own line item expense that's used to calculate net income.
And in our taxes, we have cost depletion, which means that you expect to spend the $1 billion over 10 years, let's say, and so you'd take off $100 million a year off what your income is before paying taxes, or you can do resource depletion, which is after you've used up 50% of the minerals that are estimated to be there, then you reduce your tax liability by 50% because you've used up 50% of the minerals. Is that the resource depletion calculation?
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, I'd want to go do my homework a little bit before I respond to that one.
And Mr. Chairman, I think this is something that we really should have a presentation on how cost and resource depletion factor into our taxes, because I think that we're losing a whole lot of the taxable income because it's written off not only the expenses to get the net income, but then there's either cost or resource depletion applied to further reduce your taxable income before we pay taxes, and it can be a huge portion. And I think, if I recall right, Alaska is the only state in the nation that allows companies to switch annually from cost depletion to resource depletion, depending upon which is more advantageous to reducing their tax liability to the state. So, but, Mr. Chairman, I'm recalling from, you know, resource committee meetings from years ago, so I would really like the department to come in and give us a slide presentation with some buckets, you know, some graphics or something, so that we can really understand that if we're talking about making sure that the state is getting its full revenue that is due under, it's still due under the statute, because the statute includes this cost and revenue depletion allowance, but understanding how that really works in the real world would be helpful to me.
Okay, if we can do that, we won't ask for that immediately. We'll give you some
next Tuesday or Wednesday or something.
or beyond. Yeah. Yeah.
And through the chair, Representative Seaton, I'll also note that that we are one of the only states that uses the net income tax liability on mining. So the depletion is usually a corporate income tax number, and we do piggyback the federal quota in corporate income tax world, and the feds are very strict about not allowing you to jump from one method of depletion to another, or depreciation, or you have to kind of pick it and stick with it. The mining net income tax is a very old tax, and you know, I don't know what the IRS code looked like back when the mining tax was brought on, but potentially they had some, they certainly weren't the same rules as they are now. So, but we'd be happy to put a presentation together and go over what the mining methodology is.
Thank you. Representative Tarr.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Fogels, just looking at the Alaska Mine Production Figures document that you gave us, because one of the conversations where I was going with my earlier questions was, you know, people are trying to understand what impact any of these changes will have on future development opportunities. If you look at Fort Knox in 2013, you know, where they almost doubled their production for that calendar year, I'm just thinking back of when, you know, the fluctuation in the commodity prices, and if that was reflected, is that reflecting the high point in prices, or what about that calendar year made it so out of step with all the other ones?
You know, Representative Tarr, through the chair, I just noticed that number myself, and I'm kind of wondering if that's not a typo in there.
Oh, okay.
I'd have to find out what happened there, because I just saw that, and it's like that's pretty significant. production increase, and typically doesn't happen in a mine like that. It's a lot more smooth. So I will double check that number right there. But typically those variations that happen are based on a number of factors. A lot of it is what's going on in the mine, in the deposit itself, the kind of ore you're getting. Sometimes you have issues with production, or you actually, you know, the company typically tries to optimize its milling procedure constantly, and they will find new ways to optimize it, to make it work better. The chemistry of the rock might change and cause things to change, you know, or just the grade changes. Every truckload of ore you pull out of a mine has a different concentration of your metal in it.
And Mr. Chairman, if I could do a follow-up.
Follow-up.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As we have these conversations, you know, on the oil and gas tax credits, for example, one of the sort of shortcomings, I think, in our work was that, you know, we didn't sort of model things along the whole range of prices and the realities that we're seeing. In applying that thinking to consideration of the mining tax here, you've said that commodity price is really what is influencing things, or that's what I heard, more than any of these other sort of underlying issues. It's more commodity price driven. If that's not accurate, please address that. But in addition, because there is such great fluctuation, how you know, how do you all, or what resources do you use in understanding how to, you know, look forward and make any predictions about what these commodity prices will be?
Representative Tarr, through the chair, I think, you know, the commodity prices have probably are the biggest driver for the mine, assuming a stable fiscal structure. You know, so I wouldn't say that that's the biggest driver necessarily. If you're going to make large changes to the fiscal structure, that could easily, you know, overshadow any changes in the commodity price change. So it kind of just depends. I'm just sort of saying, if Alaska's tax structure, as it's been over the years, you have a number of factors that would influence how much money a mine makes, and commodity prices is probably at the top of the list. Fuel prices, actually, cost of rubber for tires, as Representative Tallarico could probably tell you. I mean, I know Isabelli spends a lot of money on truck tires, and that's a big cost driver in their operations. So, but you know, typically commodity prices can be the biggest driver. But as far as what the department does, you know, we really, I mean, most of our work is environmental. We permit, we regulate, so the commodity prices aren't, you know, that big of a factor in our day-to-day work. You know, where we see the fiscal side of it is in the production royalty, and as I said, we don't have an ongoing discussion of how to propose changes to that royalty structure based on what we see commodity prices doing in the future. So it's not really a, you know, kind of a part of our thinking in our day-to-day work.
If I can, Mr. Chairman, ask
through the chair to Representative Tarr, for the purposes of modeling for a fiscal note, I believe our economists have used the futures prices and markets rather than any kind of formal modeling for future commodity prices. Again, we spend a lot of time on oil and gas prices, and we don't get those right either. So, you know, we tend to do as well as anybody else does. Mm-hmm. But, you know, our crystal balls are pretty clouded when it comes to some of these. Mm-hmm. So we all use market and financial markets with futures to estimate future prices.
And just one last follow-up on that one. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And so the $6 million looks a little on the low side relative to some of the more recent years, but was that an attempt to not, you know, get it wrong and be over-optimistic of what that might be?
To the chair, Representative Tarr, I didn't make that estimate myself, but we have seen declining commodity prices across the board over the past several years. And so, you know, in 2014... The total income from the large mines that would be subject to this tax, the 13 taxpayers that were paying in the highest tax bracket, was $561 million net income for tax purposes. And $6 million would represent about a $300 million net profit for the largest taxpayers. So that's certainly a difference in commodity prices and costs, because the other thing that affects these is that, you know, costs of equipment, et cetera, have been going up at a rate faster than inflation. Mm-hmm. So you have, you know, we have access, of course, to taxpayer confidential tax return information, which is used for estimating future costs and et cetera. So we can, you know, our economists do look at a whole variety of things, but that's, you know, kind of the range of estimated net profits under our tax regime. And, of course, that's going to vary widely year to year, as it has in the past several years. Mm-hmm. Kind of goes like this.
Mm-hmm. Representative Josephson. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Well, along those lines, you mentioned that I think in 2011 the corporate income tax on hard rock mining was pretty sizable because commodity prices were high. This bill is designed to, well, it's not designed. It theoretically generates about $6 million of new income for the state. Any idea what, on a high-end commodity year, this would generate, and
what impact that would have on the industry? Have that sort of modeling been done?
The Chair, to Representative Joseph Sank, I think we can provide that type of information. In fact, I think we may have provided some of that information in a letter that came to you today.
Okay.
That on the back of that it has some.
I see. You did provide it, and I apologize.
Okay. So,
thank you.
So we're a little bit ahead of you on this.
Yes, I'm impressed. I'm impressed.
Actually, the economist that's been doing the modeling for this, Will Bishop, is in the room, and he's been taking notes and tracking this for us.
Representative Herron.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, it's a great segue into the question I have. I wasn't here on Monday. I was on other legislative duty. But, you know, the increase, proposed increase from 7 to 9, could you, at least for me, could you explain why that? Why wasn't it 7 to 10? Why wasn't it 7 to 8.5? Why 7 to 9?
Through the Chair, Representative Herron, again, you know, tax policy is for a variety of reasons. There were estimated income, obviously, at various price points or tax rate points, and with discussion, this was discussed with a group of people within the administration, which included people from DNR and Commerce, people were familiar with the industry, and that's a decision that we came up with, very specifically why that particular number. There's more art than science there, probably, in some ways.
So, Mr. Chairman, well, that begs the question, then, is if a group of people got out and I threw a dart toward a target on the wall, and that was the best shot. It seems like to increase the taxes on an industry, it doesn't matter what the industry is there has to be a justification, and it has to be, Mr. Chairman, in my mind, there has to be where you can articulate that you understand the industry and that the industry can bear an increase because of fact A, fact B, fact C. So I would suggest it will help in the selling of this tax to the legislature is let's drill down a little bit and let's understand the analysis. And I think it's important to the legislators and to the industry to understand that, because I'd like to be able to tell my constituents, but also my own conscience, is that it wasn't just a dart and a dartboard, and just cuz. I think that's very important, Mr. Chairman. Thank you.
Thank you.
Understood. And you know, we have nothing more to present to you today. We did provide a number of backup documents to the committee, and I understand you're going to have public testimony and additional testimony in the future. So,
okay, I want to ask the committee if you have any further questions for our presenters today. They brought up some interesting points. One thing I'll add that occasionally changes production numbers, which a lot of people don't consider, in particularly in these open pit mines, is actually the Alaska climate and the weather.
Mm-hmm.
And you very easily can see a drop in production in 2013, where we had record-setting rainfall, where a lot of these places are located, makes huge, huge issues in those particular places, because they deal with that routinely. And if you think about the underground guys, every time we have a tremor or any type of earthquake, that pretty much unnerves everybody that's working in there, and it changes the way you work for a while until you forget about that shake. And then when it comes back, you're back on high alert all of the time. So it's an interesting industry, how it can be impacted with things that I'm pretty sure we're never going to be able to control. Or at least if somebody figures out how to control that, they will be the wealthiest person in the state of Alaska if they can do that. But Well, if we don't have any further questions, I do appreciate some of the information that will be provided to us at a later date. We've got a pretty busy schedule coming up, but we will have you back to talk to us about those things. Mr. Fogles?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I got past the note that apparently the production figure on my table for Fort Knox for the year 2013 should be 428,822. Not 728,822. We'll double check that and verify it and get a corrected sheet back to the committee.
Oh, okay. Thank you very much. Thank you. We appreciate you presenting to us today. I'll let the committee know that Friday we're actually going to take public testimony. I did distribute, I believe, to all of the committee members upcoming schedule for next week. It's a busy week, and we've added some. We're going to meet at some times that we're normally not scheduled for. We'll have a meeting on Tuesday. I've forgotten it now. I think Tuesday is 1 to 3, our normal time, but not our normal day. And then Wednesday morning, we'll also have a presentation from 8:30 to 10. And, of course, we'll have Monday. Pardon me?
A.M.
That's A.M. Yeah, that's not P.M. That's A.M. the notice is out for sure. I just want to make sure. Did all the committee members receive something prior? Okay, good. That's very good. Well, we have no further questions. I don't think we have any other business before the committee, so we will adjourn at 2:40. We're adjourned.